thing called machine gun.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, June 20th, 2016. Hendrix opens our podcast today. The tune is called Machine Gun. And the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with a similar kind of weapon today, the so-called assault weapon. And that's a term that can be fudged depending on whose side of the Second Amendment you prefer. But in a very important signal sent from this divided court that is still short one member, the justices let stand a lower court ruling that found the Connecticut law banning semi-automatic rifles to be constitutional. And this, I think, is a very important statement that Democrats on Capitol Hill should be listening to. And we'll get to the skirmishes post-Orlando in the U.S. Senate here in a moment. But this is an important ruling by the court, and it is not a precedent-setting ruling because they didn't actually take a position. They simply declined to hear the case and allowed the lower court ruling to stand in the Connecticut matter. And the opinion that was written by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that has been upheld says the law specifically targeted to prevent mass shootings like that in Newtown, in which the shooter used a semi-automatic assault weapon. That opinion written by Judge Jose Cabranes, who went on to say, plaintiffs complain that mass shootings are particularly rare events, and thus, even if successful, the legislation will have a minimal impact on most violent crime. That may be so, Judge Cabranes said. But gun control legislation need not strike at all evils at the same time to be constitutional. Now, Clarence Thomas, writing for a minority in a previous case, has said the overwhelming majority of citizens who own and use AR-style automatic rifles do so for lawful purposes, including self-defense and target shooting. And under our precedents, that is all that is needed for citizens to have a right under the Second Amendment to keep such weapons. So this is an important point of departure. And if Justice Scalia were still on the court, we could have expected a different outcome. Now, at the same time, the court, which, by the way, is going to be announcing decisions sometimes several each day between now and the end of June, as its term comes to a close, they also narrowed the rights of a person to avoid an illegal search and to have the evidence derived from an illegal search used against them. And this is chipping away at a long-revered right of defendants across this country. And this comes out of a case where the individual was suspected of being part of a narcotics house. And when the suspect left the house, the cops stopped him on a pretext that everyone, including Clarence Thomas, agrees was not sufficient to require a full search. But the officer who stopped him on a pretext then ran a check and discovered a warrant for a minor traffic violation. And based on that, he arrested the guy, searched him, found a baggie with meth and drug paraphernalia, and the question for the justices whether the evidence should have been suppressed. And they ruled basically that because there was an outstanding warrant, the pretext that was used to detain this man originally is irrelevant. And this earned a blistering dissent from Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who was joined on the dissenting side by Justices Kagan and Ginsburg. Sotomayor wrote, "The court today holds that the discovery of a warrant for an unpaid parking ticket will forgive a police officer's violation of your Fourth Amendment rights." And she said, "Do not be soothed by the opinion's technical language. This case allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, check it for warrants, even if you are doing nothing wrong. If the officer discovers a warrant for a fine you forgot to pay, courts will now excuse his illegal stop and will admit into evidence anything he happens to find by searching you after arresting you on the warrant." Well, I am 100% behind Justice Sotomayor here, and she noted that there are 7.8 million outstanding warrants in this country, and that in the town of Ferguson, Missouri, where these issues surfaced in a hot summer a couple of years ago, almost all of the residents, 16,000 out of 21,000 are subject to arrest because there are warrants issued in their names. So I appreciate the strong dissent from Justice Sotomayor, but it shows that our Bill of Rights is being treated more and more as an optional set of goals or morals, not a contract that we enjoy with our country. And I think that is a dangerous, dangerous change that has occurred just in recent years. Now to the U.S. Senate. I mentioned the assault weapons ban, the Supreme Court essentially saying that's constitutional. We used to have an assault weapons ban. It was authored by California Senator Dianne Feinstein. And when it expired, she tried to get it renewed. That was around 2006, I think. And since then, we have not had a ban. And that's what permitted Omar Mateen to go and buy one. Now, I want to be clear that I think this is the most direct response to the Orlando shootings. And I don't for a minute believe that if there had been an assault weapons ban, that that would have prevented Mateen from acting in this deadly and irrational way that he did. But it would have been an impediment, or it would at least have caused him to select another weapon. And it might not have had a 30-clip magazine, and the loss of life could have been less. So I do support an assault weapons ban, but the Congress is not even considering that right now. And in the Senate, Dianne Feinstein is promoting this bad idea of no fly, no buy. And I've been talking about this for days now, so forgive me if you find it repetitious. But I just think this is very dangerous legislation because it is based on extra constitutional police state activities, namely that they can put you on a watch list or the no-fly list without any due process. Your rights are completely bulldozed in that effort, and it gives supreme power to the FBI and other law enforcement agencies who control these lists. And so I think it's very bad. And while, you know, I understand that the Democrats are trying to score political points in an election year, they're trying to break the Republican obstruction to any reasonable gun control legislation whatsoever. And on that, I understand their motivation. But the low-hanging fruit that they're trying to pick here is poisoned. And they seem oblivious to that. And therefore, I'm glad that Republicans are not going to just bend over and allow this bill to be passed. Some have raised the process issues, and as I mentioned last week, there is an opportunity here to fix the broken system of the watch lists, and if that were the case, I could probably live with a ban on gun purchases for people who are on some sort of a list if it is done in a constitutional and transparent manner. But I don't think our government has any intention whatsoever, either in the executive branch, the law enforcement people, or in the legislative branch on Capitol Hill. We'll be watching this carefully. We do expect the Senate to start conducting votes on these amendments as soon as today. The Orlando gunman, we are being told, made these phone calls to the 9/11 emergency service in Orlando while he took a break from peppering the crowd at the Pulse nightclub with his AR-15. And I want to say that I'm extremely skeptical of what we're being fed here. Skeptical, I'm sorry, is the word I'm looking for. Because they are giving us edited and redacted transcripts. They're telling us that allowing the public to hear these 911 tapes would just reopen wounds and would be too painful. Well, I call bullshit on that. Because the government is manipulating the information that we get to see. And so, with the release of these redacted transcripts, I have looked at three different news accounts about it, and I'm going to compare them here. The New York Times reports that the gunman told the operator that he wants the United States to stop bombing Syria and Iraq. He threatened more attacks in the coming days from alleged accomplices who don't appear to exist. He also flatly and falsely said that he had explosives inside the nightclub and that if they tried to bust him out of there, quote, I'm gonna ignite it if they try to do anything stupid. We're also told that he spoke in Arabic. He claimed responsibility in the name of God the Merciful. We're told by an FBI agent that he made these comments in a chilling, calm, and deliberate manner. The FBI included no mention by Mateen of any hatred of gays or a desire to attack a gay nightclub. And it's interesting because this whole sub-narrative about Omar Mateen being a regular at the club and having issues with sexuality, participating in gay dating sites like Jacked, that's being scrubbed from the American version of the narrative. And Advice News, they report that Mateen placed his first call 30 minutes after opening fire in the nightclub. And he said to the operator, "Praise be to God, prayers as well as peace be upon the prophet of God. I let you know I'm in Orlando and I did the shootings." Now, right there is such a contradiction. To invoke Islam and peace upon the prophet of God and then say, "I did the shootings." That is certainly irrational and highly inconsistent. So, returning now to the New York Times account, the FBI made public only partial transcripts of Mateen's calls today and none of the audio recordings, though officials and shooting survivors have said publicly that in the calls, the gunman pledged his allegiance to the Islamic State and to its leader. The FBI redacted those statements from the transcript, along with parts of the conversation in which Mateen voiced support for other extremist ideologies. One of the critics of this is House Speaker Paul Ryan, and I rarely agree with this Republican from Wisconsin, but he fired off, "Selective editing of this transcript is preposterous. We know the shooter was a radical Islamist extremist inspired by ISIS. We also know he intentionally targeted the LGBT community. The administration should release the full unredacted transcript so the public is clear-eyed about who did this and why." Well, I don't agree with everything here that Ryan said, but I agree with his summation that they should release this, and not only the transcript, they should release the recording so that we have some confidence that we're being told the truth. Because at this point, it's a trust-me relationship between official government leakers, a few named spokespersons, and the evidence is being managed in ways that I find offensive. So Agent Hopper from the Florida FBI said, "Well, part of the redacting is meant to not give credence to individuals who've done terrorist acts in the past." That may refer to the Tsarnaev brothers in the Boston bombing, which we're told Mateen has referenced both in his contacts with the FBI in the past and allegedly in these calls to the 911 operator. Let's see, now switching to the account again from Vice, which published part of the redacted transcript, and I'll just read this segment to you. The operator says, "Emergency 911, this is being recorded." Mateen says, "In the name of God, the merciful, the beneficial," in Arabic. The operator says, "What?" And he goes on, "Praise be to God and prayers as well as peace be upon the prophet of God," in Arabic. Then he says, "I let you know I'm in Orlando and I did the shootings." Operator, "What's your name?" Mateen, "My name is, I pledge of allegiance to omit it." Now, we can assume that is al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, but we only assume that based on the representations of our government. We have no proof that that's who he pledged allegiance to. And, of course, release of the original information would clear that up. The operator then says, "Okay, what's your name?" And Mateen says, "I pledge allegiance to," again, it is omitted, "may God protect him on behalf of," omitted. Operator, "All right, where are you at?" Mateen, "In Orlando." Operator, "Where in Orlando?" And then Mateen ended the call. So this, of course, is certainly interesting. It is damaging. It promotes the government's narrative that he did this in some manner related to the Islamic State. But what the New York Times didn't report, and what I also don't see in the Vice report, is that he pledged allegiance and made references to more than one Islamic violent group. So the one other thing here before I get to that from the Vice report is that they report that the Orlando police chief explained that after police initially entered the nightclub, the shooting stopped for about 3 hours until the police, you know, blew down a wall and tried to rescue those hostages in a bathroom with Mateen. So now to the version of the report on the FBI release by Spencer Ackerman at The Guardian, which is a London-based paper. Ackerman is based here in the U.S. in New York. They open by saying that the nightclub killer described himself as an Islamic soldier. Now, why wasn't that included in the New York Times account? That's a pretty strong statement that, again, is attributed to Mateen. So the Guardian account continues, investigators have said they're examining Mateen's apparently tortured sexuality as a possible motive or contributing factor. Several acquaintances have considered Mateen to have been closeted and at war internally with his sexual identity. An NPR report said that investigators have not found telltale signs associated with Islamist radicalization, such as a change in mosques or abrupt shifts in behavior or family associations. Now, I think it's important that The Guardian was the original outlet that reported with the quoted video comments of a guy named Van Horn, who was a longtime regular at the Pulse nightclub. And I believe that this is an important angle to this case, and I think it's important that The Guardian continues to reference that while The New York Times tries to basically dispose of it. So The Guardian report goes on to say, quoting an unnamed U.S. security official, "We don't know the true nature of what his allegiance may be or may not be. He claimed allegiance to both the Islamic State and Hezbollah, even though both of them are fighting each other. Unless he is of a Swiss bent, meaning that he's some sort of a neutral guy, I don't know that we can just take his word for his allegiances." And that Mateen's statements have either been disproven or been incongruous with reality. So this clearly undermines the government, the U.S. government narrative that this was an ISIS-inspired terrorist event. It's inconvenient, and so the New York Times appears to go along with our government and either downplay or dismiss it. And I think it's an important thread for investigators to pursue, and I'm certainly willing to wait for any definitive statement about the motivation by Mateen. And toward the end of the article by Spencer Ackerman in The Guardian, another quote, "It remained unclear why the FBI released only partial aspects of Mateen's calls, which constitute the lion's share of evidence for his claimed allegiance to the Islamic State. Reportedly, Mateen repeated his invented connections to the Boston Marathon bombers on the call, as well as pledging simultaneous loyalties to Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda." So this is, to me, very important information. And it's one of the reasons that in our weekly NewsBud video report, I included coverage of the Orlando bombing, but more importantly, the political responses to it. And I'm linking to the YouTube clip, the link where you can view our 30-minute video news report from NewsBud, and that is available today. So click on over and take a look. And while we're talking about NewsBud, I want to mention that we're really excited. We have 34 hours to go as I speak to you right now for the deadline for our Kickstarter campaign. We are just under $163,000, and we learned on Friday, as I mentioned to you, that we are in contention to become the top funded journalism project at Kickstarter.com in its entire history. We need to reach just a little over $10,000 more to achieve that goal, and I'm hoping that you can help us reach out to people and win some new contributions to reach that level by the end of the campaign on Tuesday. And I believe the final deadline is at 11 p.m. Pacific time here in California. Also, I want to take a moment to thank the people who continue to support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I went to the P.O. Box over the weekend. Albert Valencia, who lives behind the Orange Curtain in Southern California, just renewed his annual subscription. Albert, thank you very much. Also, Diane Noland, who sent me a note with a big old stamp that says I'm voting for Bernie, she just upgraded her subscription from a monthly to an annual. And Diane, I really appreciate that. And it's always a predictable. If I go to the post office after the first of the month, there's a check from Paul L. Sesser in Durham, California, one of our most generous and longest supporters of the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thank you, one and all. And if you want to become a subscriber, you know the drill. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and you can take it from there. So in response to Orlando, Donald Trump continues to stoke fears of Muslims. And he is either ignoring the reality that you as a listener to this podcast are quite well aware of, or he is just ignorant. And what I'm talking about is the massive operations of law enforcement led by the FBI to infiltrate and monitor the activities of thousands, if not millions, of innocent Muslims across the United States. And he appears oblivious to all this because on CBS Sunday, he said, "I think profiling is something we're going to have to start thinking about as a country. When you look at Israel, you look at others. They do it, and they do it successfully. And, you know, I hate the concept of profiling, but we have to start using common sense." He went on to say, to restate his earlier calls for more scrutiny of mosques, suggesting the country could implement something along the lines of the New York City surveillance program, which was shut down after it was shown to be unconstitutional. And this just indicates that he does appear to be clueless about what Obama has quietly achieved. That's really a strange word to use, but that's what came to mind. Obama has rolled out and solidified the programs that were started under Bush. And because there's so many Republicans who claim that he's a Muslim, I guess it just goes without criticism from almost all sides. And I am very offended by it. I have raised alarms here on many occasions, not only about the infiltration and profiling of Muslims, but their targeting for frame-ups under domestic terrorism prosecutions by the FBI and our bulked-up law enforcement system in this country. And speaking of Trump, he told Corey Lewandowski, "You're fired." I don't know if I did that very well, but, you know, everybody has said that after they've heard Trump say it. Anyway, Corey Lewandowski was the youngish guy who was the campaign manager for Trump up until today. But apparently his children, the three adults who are his closest advisors, apparently, they said Corey's got to go. And, of course, his campaign is in disarray. He has no experience running a national campaign. He appears to be trying to do it on the cheap, and he, I guess, imagines that there's more infrastructure that the Republican Party has that he can just acquire or access, and so I think he recognized that he is adrift, and they're going to try to address it with a change of the guard. On Friday, I led my News and Comment podcast with the report that 51 diplomats in the U.S. State Department signed a dissent memo. We still haven't seen the actual text of this memo, just leaked quotes from it. But these people at the State Department obviously are deeply frustrated by Obama's incoherent approach to the war in Syria, which is approaching the 2-year landmark without any congressional authorization. That'll be in August. And I think that these dissenters, on the one hand, did a public service by raising the issues of this ridiculous effort that we've undertaken that really has no purpose, no defined mission, no targeted outcome, other than the vague notion that we'd like to see the Islamic State go away and we'd like to see Bashar al-Assad leave the leadership post there in Damascus. And so these diplomats are saying that we should use cruise missiles and our military assets in the air to attack the Assad government directly, and that will put more pressure on them to move toward a diplomatic solution. Now, I can't say how ridiculous I think their proposal is. And it might have been something that would have worked up until the point that Russia entered the fray in Syria. And here's an example. Last Thursday, there were Russian fighters in the air over Syria's border with Iraq. And the town that was targeted is called the Al-Tanf border crossing between Syria and Iraq. This is an area where the U.S. has these so-called moderate fighters that we support. And we got pretty pissed off when we figured out that the Russians were trying to bomb our people there. So there is a system now set up. We scrambled a couple of our jets, and there is a communication channel on the radio that they use. So we have American pilots talking to Russian pilots at the same time that authorities on the ground are scrambling to communicate between the U.S. and Russian command posts. This led to a video conference a couple of days later, where American officials told the Russians that their strikes continued even after they were officially informed of Allied air support that was underway. And at a certain point, when our jets left to go refuel, the Russian fighters returned and hit the targets. And this is the kind of skirmish that could easily spin out of control. All they have to do is shoot down one American fighter jet, and the Republicans will demand that we invade Syria the next day. And this is what diplomats at the State Department are proposing? I'm shocked by this, and I have invited Peter Van Buren, who used to work at the State Department, to join us for an in-depth interview. We're scheduled to talk on Tuesday, and I'll release that to you as soon as I possibly can. Well, starting on Friday, the announcement was issued that the Iraqi military has successfully dislodged the Islamic State from Fallujah. And they're playing down the role of the United States, but we certainly provided air support and those ubiquitous advisors that we claim are just, saying, hey, shoot over here, Iraqi. But this is a signal achievement for the Baghdad-based government. They now tell us they control 80% of Fallujah, which was the first major city taken by the Islamic State when it began its expansion in 2014. And so it does appear that gains are being made on the ground. In Syria, it's not so clear. The effort is to dislodge the Islamic State from Raqqa. And while that is being attempted, I don't have any progress that can be reported at this point. Back to the U.S. and domestic politics, here is an achievement of the Bernie Sanders for President campaign. President Obama, Hillary Clinton, and other Democrats, according to the New York Times, are rallying around proposals to expand Social Security and increase benefits. Now, think about the turnabout for Obama, who was just a few years ago, after he was reelected, working on his so-called grand bargain, a grand sellout of the New Deal and Social Security in particular. He was proposing to curtail future Social Security benefits by changing the way cost of living increases were calculated, and he included a proposal for that in his budget request back in 2013. So he was very serious on giving up on improvements to Social Security, and Sanders has changed that. So the statement from the president on June 1st in Elkhart, Indiana, it's time we finally made Social Security more generous and increased its benefits so that today's retirees and future generations get the dignified retirement they've earned. And we can start paying for it by asking the wealthiest Americans to contribute a little bit more. And that's true. All you got to do is lift the FICA cap. It's at about $118,000, $120,000 in income now. And so people who earn more than that don't pay more than lower-income people do into Social Security. That's the easy fix for it. And I thank Bernie Sanders for promoting a whole new look at Social Security. Now, another Sanders initiative is to change the process of the Democratic presidential nomination effort, the primaries in particular. And there are two very strong sentiments that have been expressed. The Democratic Party of California on Sunday passed a resolution calling for a broad overhaul of how the party nominates its candidates. And it's notable that Christine Pelosi, the daughter of the House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, and a major player in California politics in the party, she co-sponsored a resolution with a Sanders backer named Daraka Larimore Hall. And the gist of this is that it calls for Democratic governors and members of Congress to lose their status as superdelegates. They would attend the convention as non-voting guests. Members of the Democratic National Committee would still be superdelegates, but would be required to vote for the candidate who won their constituency. Now, I support this, but of course, I'm not really a member of the Democratic Party anymore. And people who are staunch members want to close the party to the Sanders independent voters, and they also want to maintain the superdelegates as a way to fend off a future insurgent like Bernie Sanders. And so the Congressional Black Caucus voted unanimously to oppose any idea to eliminate the superdelegates or the creation of uniform open primaries in all states. They like this broken system just the way it is. And let me note that the Congressional Black Caucus is tainted because there are many fine members of it, but the caucus itself has accepted money from a lot of ugly corporate interests that I think severely compromise its posture of being a representative of minorities and, in general, people who are outside the political process. Strong editorial today in the New York Times entitled The Broken Promise of Closing Guantanamo, and it pins the blame mostly on Republicans in Congress, and the blame should be put on Congress, but it's not just Republicans. There are plenty of Democrats who have supported these awful pieces of legislation, limiting the president's options. So the New York Times appears to be accepting that Obama will not succeed in closing Guantanamo before he leaves next January. But they are supporting a call to allow the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture to visit Guantanamo. Now, this is something we have not allowed since we opened the facility in early 2002, and Obama has really kept the same playbook as the Republican administration before him on saying, look, we're not torturing anybody, but you can't come and inspect that. And because of the force feedings that continue on hunger strikers and many of the techniques like indefinite solitary confinement, the Guantanamo facility should be inspected by the UN, and I hope Obama will change policy and permit that. Here in California, we are really grieving, at least sports fans are, because Cleveland's Cavaliers defeated the Golden State Warriors in Oakland last night by only 4 points. It was a very close game, and I congratulate Cleveland as a, I was born in the Buckeye State in Cincinnati, and I feel the pain that Cleveland waited 52 years for this championship. And I congratulate them. But here in Oakland, we've got more serious problems than basketball. The police department, which has been rogue for at least 13 years, it has been under the control or at least the advice of a federal court for about 10 years. Well, the scandals continue. And the mayor accepted the resignation of one police chief who's been there for 2 years. And she appointed a replacement who she had to fire. Then she appointed a third person who resigned. And now she has said she's not going to promote anybody who's been a police person to run the department on the interim basis. She's appointed the city administrator of Oakland, Sabrina Landreth, to oversee the police department. And the scandals keep piling up. There's a detective who let his wife write reports. There is a texting scandal, a copycat of the one from San Francisco across the bay. And most notably, there are 21 law enforcement officers from Oakland and nearby agencies accused of participating in sexual activity with a girl who was underage when she started servicing some of these cops. She's now in her early 20s, and we're told that she was 18 when she had sex with many of these officers. But she is the daughter of an Oakland police dispatcher and somehow used her charms to get involved with so many of these cops. And it is just another serious scandal and stain on a police department that can't really afford additional scandals. And I've got a couple of briefs for you today before I wrap up. It was a remarkable event, and I've seen some of the video from Okinawa over the weekend. More than 65,000 people attended a protest rally in the town of Naha, and they're protesting the most recent crime committed, or at least attributed to an American who is stationed at one of the American military bases in Okinawa. In this case, it's a U.S. civilian who works on the base, arrested on suspicion of murdering a local woman. And we ought to get the message. We are not welcome in Okinawa. And yet we continue to work with the Japanese government to force our bases on this island. The majority of U.S. military in Japan are on Okinawa. And it is unsustainable, and we've got to face that sooner or later. In Venezuela, the food shortages are so severe now that food deliveries to grocery stores are made by armored car. Soldiers stand watch over bakeries. Police fire rubber bullets at desperate mobs storming grocery stores. And this has been going on for weeks now. In the last 2 weeks, there have been more than 50 food riots. And in the city of Cumana, the public there, a crowd, forced open a large metal gate and poured into a supermarket, and they just cleared it of everything they could find, because things have reached a desperate, desperate situation now in Venezuela. 87% of citizens say they don't have enough money to buy food, and 72% of monthly wages are being spent on food alone, as inflation and shortages driven by the low price of crude oil have hammered the Venezuelan economy. And finally today, the new count of people who are considered displaced around the globe has reached 65 million. That's more than the entire population of Great Britain. And many of these people are displaced in their own countries, about 41 of the 65 million. But that puts 24 million people displaced outside their own countries. And this is the incredible pressure that Europe is facing. The United States continues to avoid it. At most, we have agreed to absorb 10,000 Syrians by the end of this year. But it's moving very slowly, and it's not likely that figure will be achieved. So we're watching the rest of the world absorb the collateral damage, if you will, caused by our military misadventures, for the most part. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. Put it up on Facebook and pass it around, okay? I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Smile.